They carried her all the way to the courtroom and then went up to the fourth floor, where Grossman greeted them, coming to assist. As they helped her into one of the courtroom's black chairs, Catherine gazed around at the nondescript room. As it was a hearing before the Industrial Commission, it looked more like a meeting room than a court. It was, in fact, the office of the county auditor. It had a diamond-patterned tiled floor and was dominated by a large wooden table with sturdy legs. Chairs were set around it for the key players and then ranged in semicircles beyond that for spectators. Catherine's friends were already there, including Pearl Payne and Marie Rossiter, yet the women weren't the only ones present. Just as the New Jersey girl's case had done a decade before, the women's plight had captured the imagination of the nation. Reporters and photographers from across the country thronged the room. Although the media had turned out for the trial, it seemed the Radium Dial executives had not. Neither had all its legal team, for only Arthur Madgett was present, seated next to the arbitrator, or judge, at the big table. There was no Walter Bachrach, no Mr. Reed, no President Ganley, no one but Madgett to represent the firm. Perhaps they thought it was beneath their attention, or perhaps some other reason kept them from the court. Catherine looked closely at the judge. This was the man who would decide her fate. George B. Marvel was 67 years old, a round-faced gentleman with white hair and spectacles, which he wore positioned towards the end of his small nose. He had been a lawyer and a bank president prior to joining the Industrial Commission. Catherine wondered what he would make of her case. As she took in her surroundings, waiting for the trial to begin at 9 a.m., the press took in the sight of her. Mrs. Donahue, the Chicago Herald Examiner later wrote, could hardly stand alone. Her arms were no larger than a child's, and her face was drawn and pinched. Her dark eyes burned feverishly behind rimless glasses. The Times, somewhat unkindly, called her a toothpick woman. Catherine sat at the main table, with Tom seated just behind her. She carefully pulled off her big fur coat and placed it neatly on her lap, but she kept her hat on. She seemed to be cold all the time these days, frozen by the lack of fat on her body and by her failing heart. Feeling the pus starting to ooze again in her mouth, she pulled out a patterned handkerchief and kept it by her. She seemed almost constantly to have to hold it to her mouth. Grossman checked with her to see if she was ready, and she nodded briskly. The lawyer was dressed in his usual three-piece tweed suit, his eyes bright with anticipation of the job ahead. For more than half a year he had worked tirelessly on the women's case. He knew both he and Catherine were well prepared. "We do not belong," Grossman stated in his opening to the case, "to that resigned class of victims who stretch forth unsuspecting throats to the sharpened sword of even so distinguished an adversary as the law firms of record for respondent in this case. Under the intrepid Illinois Industrial Commission, larger and larger grows the brightening rainbow of our hopes for the right against the wrong and the weak against the strong. Human lives," he continued, bringing his introduction around to the woman at the centre of the case, "were saved among our country's army of defence because Catherine Donahue painted luminous dials on instruments for our forces. To make life safe, she and her co-workers are among the living dead. They have sacrificed their own lives. Truly an unsung heroine of our country, our state and country owe her a debt."